I have to tell you a story. I just had a flashback a minute ago thinking about getting up on this podium. This is a lectern, that's a podium. Just a reminder, but I think I was a sophomore at college, which would be about 1968, and I had a teacher named Richard Pulchet. He's about 6'5 and a half, very flamboyant, kind of swashbuckling type personality, and just an ebullient type of person. And he would always do strange things that were a very funny guy, and sad he's long since gone and had a pretty hard life after leaving. But I will say that one day he came running into the lecture hall in the Fine Arts Building for second year Bible, and he came running down the hallway, and there's probably a stage maybe that height. And he's real long-legged. He's an inch and a half shorter than I am, but longer legs than mine by far. And he had his briefcase in one hand and his Bible in another, and he just leaped with one foot. Just, I don't know what in the world he was thinking, and he caught his heel. Now, this is a senior minister in the Word, caught his heel and literally fell flat on his face, bang, threw his briefcase and books up against the wall all the way across the room, and 200 horrified sophomores watching. You know, back in those days, 30 years ago, you know, when a minister walked by, you thought the earth shook. Instead, you just feel it shake when they fall down. and to see him do that was just, you know, and he got up like nothing had happened, face brilliant crimson, and gave us the lecture and gathered everything up. I had not thought about that for I don't know how long. Anyway, I'm going to give you a scripture and then do something I never do, and that's give you the title and see if you can figure out how I can give you the title to my sermon after giving you this scripture. See if you can figure out how both can be part of the same sermon or both even be right. Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. Let's see if this sermon doesn't explain what has appeared to be a Bible conflict to many people for a long time. And as the sermon develops, see if you can figure out what the answer to the conflict is. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 1. And this conflict, by the way, has been one my uncle, who's not in the church, never has been, but he, I don't know, every time I go visit him, I'm going to stay with him next week out in Dana Point, California, and he'll mention this to me. He just loves to mention this to me because his nephew's a minister. Matthew 7:1, judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. And with what measure you meet, it shall be measured to you again. And why behold you the mote that is in your brother's eye, but consider not the beam that is in your own eye? Or how will you say to your brother, let me pull out the mote out of your eye, it's a little kind of a splinter, and behold the beam is in your own eye, you know, great big huge beam of wood. You hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of your own eye, and then shall you see clearly to cast out the mote out of your brother's eye. Judge not that you be not judged. The title of the sermon is Judge, Lest You Be Judged. Well, how can that be if it says judge not, lest you be judged? How can you give a sermon entitled Judge, Lest You Be Judged? Or another title could be Judge, Lest You Be Condemned. There's your first clue. John 3:17. Everybody is familiar with John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Learned it when I was 4 years old wearing a bow tie in the basement Sunday school class at Market Street Presbyterian Church in Lima, Ohio. I could rattle that off at age four. But verse 17 I never learned. And that's the verse we want to read right after it. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. Now we just read judge not that you be not judged. And now we read, God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. Okay, to that let's add this verse, Matthew 23:23. Now this is probably going to be one of those sermons that you'll get some of it when I give it, maybe most of it, maybe some of you will get all of it, as it were, but some of you may have to go back and put these verses together and reevaluate how they work together and what the core of the message really means to fully get it. Matthew 23:23. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, these little garden herbs and vegetables, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. He says, you're tithing on all these little things in your garden. And he goes on and says, you know, these ought you to have done. Nothing wrong with tithing. A lot of people seem to feel New Testament tithing isn't valid. And he should have said, these ought you to have not done. But he said, these ought you to have done. And not to leave the other, the law, judgment, mercy, and faith, undone. What does it mean there? Judge not. But here we read that you shouldn't omit judgment. How are you supposed to judge not? But Christ said, don't omit the more important things in the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. You can actually take that statement two ways, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, almost as though it could be a colon, judgment, mercy, and faith. It also can be taken and omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. But either way, judgment's there. How do you explain that? Luke 11, 42. Luke 11 and verse 42. Now these are fundamental principles. The very first scripture I read essentially is Sermon on the Mount. The very first of the principles that Christ taught. First time he ever gave a sermon. He said, don't judge, lest you be judged. Luke 11 and verse 42. But woe unto you, Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs, and pass over judgment and the love of God. That's interesting. Same account. You pass over judgment and the love of God. Now, the only difference that you find between that and Matthew 23:23 is it says the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Here you find, he says, but you omit judgment, and then he calls it the love of God, which is a summary of the law, mercy, and faith. You can make a note. Without going back to Matthew 7, let's look at the word judge. The Greek word is krino, K-R-I-N-O, krino. For those of you who like to write this type of stuff down, it's 2919 in the Concordance and Strong's. It means to distinguish, decide, where it says judge not, to distinguish, decide, by implication to try, condemn, punish, damn, sentence to, or think. So, don't distinguish, decide, try, condemn, punish, damn, or sentence to people. Don't think to do that. That you be not tried, condemned, punished, damned, sentenced to, after you have been distinguished and decided upon, in effect. When you break down the meaning of the word, there's more there. When you go to Matthew 23:23, you have the word judge in verb form, judgment. Remember, we just read, but have omitted judgment, mercy, faith, the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. The Greek there is 29:20, one word later. Noun form of the verb. Interesting. The word, write this out. I'd like you to just write it out. Ready? Here we go. K-R-I-S-I-S. Pronounced Croesus. Look at the word. What word can you think of in the English language that looks an awful lot like Croesus? Change one letter and pronounce it differently. What have you got? You got the word crisis. The English word crisis comes from the noun form of judge, crisis, not crino, which is the verb form, crisis, and it means a decision. Now, in the English language, unfortunately, people have sort of come to the conclusion that a decision, in some cases it's true, is a crisis. If you don't know what to do in the decision, then you really do have a crisis. But a lot of people omit crisis. They omit decision making. Or, if you will, they omit the ability to handle, using the English, crises. Now here we're supposed to be able to handle crises. Not just tithe on all the little herbs over here in the garden. That's good. Should not leave that undone, but you got to be able to handle crisis. I use the Greek, interchangeable. You got to be able to make decisions. Decisions shouldn't be crises, by the way. Some of them, I suppose, are. When you read in Luke 11:42, it talks about judgment and the love of God. Same account, but rendered a little differently by Luke than Matthew. Exact same word, crisis. That didn't change. It's exactly what it's talking about. You have to be able to handle decision making. Now let's jump to the Old Testament. Let's look at Micah chapter 6. Micah chapter 6. Now, some of this, as we develop, becomes fascinating because I have not forgotten, I ask you not to forget, the statement I made at the beginning of the sermon, which is an absolute contradiction to Matthew 7:1. Judge not that you be not judged. And the title of the sermon is Judge, lest you be judged. How can that be? Well, the balance of the sermon really is going to answer that. Micah 6, verse 6. Wherewith shall I call before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? That's a lot of oil. Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression? If I take my oldest child and sacrifice him in front of God, like Abraham was told to do with Isaac, didn't have to do it, but told to, will God say, well, that is just wonderful. This man absolutely loves and serves me. It's not so wonderful for the firstborn, but in theory, God asks, is that good, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? If you sin, can you kill your son to pay for your sins? Does that please God? Will God be pleased if he looks down and says, wait a minute, there's sin here. Somebody's got to die. And the man who does it says, well, that's simple. I'll just kill my kid. It's a rhetorical question. Obviously, the answer is no. Verse 8, he has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God? Now, before I get into the key word there, which is to do justly, let's just make a little kind of a sidelight. It says to walk humbly with your God. That's not really what it's saying. Incidentally, if you look in the margin, it will actually tell you it should be translated to humble yourself to walk with God. So what's the difference? Huge difference. To walk humbly with God is a good thing to do. But for most people, they are so proud, so haughty, so arrogant, so conceited, so vain. Pick the scriptural word that you find describing that quality, whichever one you like. They're all a little different, but much the same. They are so much that way that most people literally have to lower themselves to the level of God. The very being who made everything is beneath most human beings. That's why it's important, it's not the subject of this sermon, but it's important that you understand, you ought to correct that and go with what's in the margin. The Hebrew actually means humble yourself. That means lower yourself to walk with God. Again, not the subject of the sermon, but I wanted to comment on it. Now, back to what does it mean to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly before your God. To do justly, the Hebrew word, now we're in the Hebrew, not Greek, is mishpat, mishpat. If you want to write it down, you can, I won't spell it out, but it's 4941 in Strong's. And it means a verdict. It means a decision, a verdict. Now, it's funny, we're told not to decide up in Matthew 7:1. Let me just keep making this absolutely clear. We're not to distinguish, to try, to condemn, to punish, to sentence. And here we're told that God requires us to render verdicts. And we've already read, of course, that we should not be omitting Croesus, though we're not supposed to preno. We're not to be omitting decisions. And now in the Old Testament, we're finding the same thing, here called a verdict. We are required to regularly in our life render verdicts. That's what it says. Now, we haven't talked about what that means. When are those verdicts? Verdicts about what? How do you arrive at those verdicts? But let's just accept the verse for what it says for a moment. This is good. I require you to render verdicts in your life and to love mercy and walk humbly with your God. Genesis 18 and verse 19. Genesis 18 and verse 19. Well, the account, of course, is Abraham in this fascinating, almost in a righteous way, a contest of wills with God, where they're discussing what's going to happen to Sodom and Gomorrah, wherein is Abraham's nephew Lot, and of course they go through this whole thing of what if there's 50 people, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. Finally, God shuts off the discussion and said, you know, if there's 10, I won't destroy it. It turns out there was one righteous person, and Lot got out, and the city got destroyed. But that's the context. We're just about to go into that discussion. Genesis 18, 17. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do? We just talked about what he's going to do. Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I know him. Wow, what an incredible thing for God to say about a man. I guess it's one of my goals, and I hope it's one of your goals, that if God were writing this about you, he could say, for I know him or her. Would be a wonderful thing to hear. Sub your name in there. That he will command his children and his household after him, and they will keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. Now here God says he's going to tell him what he's going to do to these two great cities, because he knows, among these other things, he knows that Abraham is somebody who does justice and judgment. Justice and judgment. Now, if you look up in the Hebrew, the word for justice, this is an easy number to remember, it's 6666. That's better than 666. Okay, it's four sixes in the Hebrew. Hard one to pronounce. I sat and tried to study the pronunciation, had it in my mind, I kept looking at it. The best I can say is it's saqwa. Probably saqwa in the Hebrew. T-S-E-D-A-Q-A-H. Write it down and see if you can pronounce it. I gave it my best shot. Saqwa. And it means rightness or rectitude. To do justice, that's rightness or rectitude. To do what's right. And judgment. And judgment, which is the same word that we just read in Micah, to do justly. Don't be confused. The word in Micah, to do justly, is the same word you see here for judgment. It's not the same word here in Hebrews where he said that he will do justice and judgment. It's mishpat, and it means a verdict. It also means a decision. It also means discretion. A person who's discreet knows how to make decisions, how to render verdicts. That's really what the essence of discreet means. You might just make a note. We're going to just keep on moving. Psalm 72 and verse 1. Psalm 72 and verse 1. Same Hebrew words here. Give the king your judgments, O God, your verdicts, your decisions, your discretions, O God, and your righteousness unto the king's son. The word for righteousness, of course, the word for judgments is exactly the same as judgments. The word for righteousness there is the same as the word for justice. Give the king your judgments, O God, and your justice also can be translated in the Hebrew, your righteousness unto the king's son. So judgments and righteousness are the same Hebrew words that we've read before. Now what is righteousness? David said in Psalm 119, we won't turn there, you all know the verse, I think it's 172, Psalm 119, 172, all your commandments are righteousness. So you're talking about righteousness, you're talking about God's commands. You're talking about the law of God. All right, let's continue the equation. It's going to build something that's very, very important as we move along. Unless we've laid this foundation properly, we can't move on to other things. If all God's commandments are righteousness, you can also say that all God's commandments are love. They're the love of God. Love is the keeping of the law. Love is the fulfilling of the law. You know the two New Testament verses, Romans and 1 John. So you've got, in effect, what God is saying, David wanted. He saw it in Abraham. He required it in Micah. We've already read several places in the New Testament, judgment, mercy, faith, or judgment and the love of God. Isn't that interesting? Back in Luke 11:42, we found that Christ said, but you should not have omitted judgment and the love of God. Said and called in Matthew, the law, mercy, faith. That's the love of God. In other words, let's boil it down another way. We're talking about discretion and love, decision-making, the ability to render verdicts, and the love of God. God says He requires that. We've seen it so far in the Old and New Testament. Let's jump back to the New Testament. Look at Philippians chapter 1. Now let's look at a congregation that had a particular problem. Let's see what the problem was and what Paul told them they needed to do. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 8. Philippians 1:8. For God is my record, how greatly I long after you. In other words, it means long to see you all in the bowels of Jesus Christ. Verse 9. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment. An interesting verse. This I pray. I long to see you, and I pray that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment. There should be more and more love, but it always should be mixed with knowledge and judgment. You look in the margin, you know what it says? Judgment could be translated there, good sense, just sense. Maybe another way of putting it would be discretion. That you could have love, but you'd make good decisions. I've seen people who have love, genuine love, but they don't know how to express it. They don't make good decisions. They can be busybodies. They can want to do things for people, but sometimes unconsciously actually stick their nose into something, if I may put it that way, that shouldn't have their nose in it. The Philippians apparently were growing in love, But Paul said, I'd like to see you have more knowledge and judgment. I mean, get the facts, make good decisions in the way you do it. The margin says sense. Basically, the whole theme of Philippians is an admonition all the way through to temper love and zeal. Philippians had plenty of zeal with wisdom or judgment and knowledge. 1 Kings 3, look at what Solomon prayed. Now let's put a different spin, or maybe a different light would be a better way of putting it. 1 Kings chapter 3, when he made this famous prayer of request to God. 1 Kings 3 and verse 5. God said in verse 5, what do you want? In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon. I've been to Gibeon, pretty barren place today. Once was very beautiful. To Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask what I shall give you. Make a wish is another way of saying it, almost. And Solomon said, you have showed unto your servant David, my father, great mercy, according as he walked before you in truth and in righteousness and in uprightness of heart with you. And you have kept for him this great kindness, that you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. In other words, me, Solomon. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of David my father, and I am but a little child. I know not how to go out or come in. He was humble enough to recognize he wasn't mature enough to make good decisions. We would say, man, you don't know up from down. Back then, it is kind of like you read in the Old Testament, if you today wanted to say, go jump in the lake. Back in the Old Testament, they'd say, go eat flesh. That was the equivalent of saying, go jump in the lake. Well, here, we would say, you don't know up from down. Well, it was a common phrase. If you recognized you didn't make good decisions, you weren't that wise, you'd say, I don't know how to go out or come in. Or is that like, am I going out of the house or in the house? I don't know whether I'm going in or out of the door. That's what it means. And your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered for, or counted for multitude. In other words, I'm king. I'm going to thrive on my ability to make judgments, make decisions, render verdicts. And I don't know how to go out or come in. Verse 9, give therefore your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this so great a people? And this speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said to him, because you have asked this thing and not asked for a long life for yourself, neither have asked for great riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but you have asked for yourself understanding to discern judgment. It isn't quite what he said up there. But God, let's just boil down exactly what you're asking. You say you don't know how to go out or come in. You don't know up from down. What you're asking me for is the ability to discern judgment. Understanding of heart would be certainly a part of wisdom. To judge, to discern, to decide, to render verdicts. To discern directly between good and bad. I mean, put it all together. That's what it's saying. The whole purpose of judgment is to be able to discern what is right and wrong. We live in a society, brethren, anymore where they don't know right from wrong. If I did things wrong sometimes as a child, my dad would look at me and, oh, he just pierced me. He says, son, you know right from wrong. And I wasn't in the church when he did that, but I lived in a generation that far more than now did know the difference between right and wrong. Just basic stuff. It wasn't a generation where people, it was a famine, you loot. You know, there was famine in my father's generation. It's called the Great Depression. But it didn't have the bishop of the Catholic Church standing up and saying, well, it's rightfully yours, so loot. And I've read the quotes. It's called the ability to understand in the most fundamental sense, right from wrong. People kill people. And after it's over, somehow after you're done in court, the person who got shot was the perpetrator, and the person who did it was the victim. Some of these lawyers and judges are incredible. They don't have judgment, and yet they're called judges. It's the Spirit of God, and the fruit of the Spirit of God, of love, which enables you to do that which is right. To make the decision, remember, the law is love, it is righteousness, and to do what is right is what the law of God tells you. You put that with judgment, and it's deciding to do what love is, the law of God. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Remember the first verse, judge not. Well, then let's fit this verse in. How does this one fit? 1 Corinthians 2:14, but the natural man receives not the things of the Spirit of God. True enough. For they are foolishness to him. Mr. Armstrong used to say, to teach the things of God to a carnal mind is like trying to teach higher math to a cow. You don't get anywhere. It was a great analogy. Neither can he know them because they're spiritually discerned. You might as well add it. He doesn't have the Spirit of God. But he that is spiritual judges all things. Interestingly, though, yet he himself is judged of no man. What does that mean? He judges all things. And yet he's not judged by anybody. If he makes good judgments, nobody can judge him. If he's his own best judge, and he's judging all things because he's spiritual, there's nothing left for anybody to judge. That's what it's talking about. The Greek word is interesting. It's anakrino. It's not krino. It's anakrino. You know what it means? See if this doesn't sound like Ken Starr to you. It means to scrutinize. This is what he does. He judges all things. Okay, where you have the word judge there? Just substitute all these words. Ready? Here we go. Scrutinize. Investigate. Interrogate. Determine. Examine. Judge and search. So when you read, he that is spiritual scrutinizes, investigates, interrogates, determines, examines, judges, and searches all things. Now, I want to jump ahead of myself and tell you a little bit more about that, but I'm not going to. I'm going to let the sermon develop and see if you can figure out a little bit more about it. What does that mean? What does that mean in light of what we have said? I'm not going to jump ahead. We're going to stay in 1 Corinthians and go to chapter 10. And let's talk about a decision that we had to make. You'll remember from my 90 Reasons sermons, I think it probably was the third tape, I talked about how you know when Christ has reestablished his name in the midst of an apostasy. If there are 300 to 400 major doctrinal changes, would God leave it up to everybody to decide on their own where their line in the sand is that they're going to leave? Well, I think they teach born again. I'm out of here. Somebody else, well, I don't know. They say that the truths about the identity of Israel are wrong. I'm out of here. Somebody else says, well, I don't know. I think if they start playing with the gospel and we go from the kingdom of God to the gospel of Jesus Christ, I'm out of here. Somebody else may draw a different line. They threw out prophecy. I'm gone. They don't believe in the 7,000-year plan of God. I'm gone. Where do you draw the line? Well, where you draw the line is where Christ draws the line, and here it is. And it has to do with judgment. And it'll tell you, if you really understand this, exactly when Christ has to keep his promise to never leave or forsake the church, when the leaders have. Notice, 1 Corinthians 10:6. Now these things were our examples to the intent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be you idolaters as were some of them. As it's written, the people sat down to eat and drink, rose up to play. Talking about idolatry here, worshiping false gods. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur you, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Now all these things happened unto them for examples, They're written for our admonition, upon whom are the ends of the world come. Okay, so they're written for us. The ends of the world have come on us. Wherefore, here's the well-known verse, and everybody misses the context that leads in and out of it. Wherefore, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Think. Examine. There is no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man, including having contact with idolatry and some of these other things that are described there, lust, which is a form of idolatry, Colossians says. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you may be able to, it should be translated, to escape. All right, now there are trials that come on God's people where they're promised a way of escape. But what are you talking about here? What's he talking about? Verse 14, wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. If you want to know when you have to flee in the midst of an apostasy, I'll tell you when it is. You flee when a false god enters. When they start saying you can wear crosses or the Trinity is who you worship, false pagan 1,700-year-old man-made non-existent god, that's equivalent to saying, brethren, from now on we're going to worship Buddha or the Hindu Trinity, you know. Can't think of Vishnu and who are the others? Krishna, Vishnu, maybe I forget the other three, the other one. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. Christ makes a way of escape. Many times said, my wife remembers, I said, after they introduced the Trinity, I said, here comes the cross. And it came about 8 weeks later. Now, if you're wise, if you want to do what's right, I'm going to speak to you as though you're wise. And you make a decision. You anacrino what I say. You scrutinize, you investigate, you interrogate, you determine, you judge. And yet the sermon started out, judge not. But here it says, you judge. If you're in the face of idolatry, flee. It's like fornication. Those times, and I wonder, should I fornicate? Maybe I should fornicate. No, you just flee. Boom. You're in the being faced with idolatry, you just go. You flee. But you have to make a judgment. The kind of judgment that a wise man would make. You get out. We won't turn there, but 1 Corinthians 12:8 says that the chief spiritual gift is wisdom. Now, let's shift gears. How do we become good judges, brethren? How do you become a good judge? How do you do that? We're not supposed to omit that weightier matter. How do you become a good judge now that we understand that we're not to judge lest we be condemned? Which means we are not to condemn other people lest we be condemned. But how do you learn to become a good judge in your own life? That's the question. If you're talking about other people, don't judge them. Don't condemn them. If you're talking about your own life, you have to learn to prosecute. Back to, as I said, sort of like Kinstar. To investigate, to interrogate, to examine, to question, to scrutinize, to prosecute your own thoughts when they're wrong. And make good judgments. How do you do that? The word judge means to form an opinion, make a decision, to discernment. That's what it means. You look up in any dictionary. Hebrews 5:14. Hebrews 5 and verse 14. Please turn over there. Very interesting verse on this subject. Verse 12, it says, for when for the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God. You're still hung up on the ABCs, Hebrews. You're supposed to be moving on, and you become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. For everyone that uses milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness. The reason, this hurts, but some people have to hear it. for he's a baby. I hate it when my sister would say that. Yeah, you're just a baby. How do you feel? If God had to say to you, you handle milk and you can't handle meat, and then says, you're just a baby. Somebody calls you a baby. Do you feel good about that? Well, I don't. But that's what somebody who cannot do verse 14 really is. But strong meat belongs to them that are of full age, the grown-ups, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Exactly the gift that was given to Solomon, that God says we all have to have, that David prayed for his son to have. Interestingly enough, in Psalm 72:1, David prayed to God in Psalm 72:1 that his son would have that gift. And you know what? His son came along and prayed for the gift, and God gave it. And he not only answered Solomon's prayer, he answered Solomon's dad's prayer about what he wanted Solomon to have. And that is the ability to discern good and evil. And the only way you can do that, brethren, it's called by reason of use. You have to over and over and over again practice the art of krisis, which unfortunately the world calls a crisis. And that's just any time you got to make a decision. And I guess if you can't make a decision, then for a person it is a crisis. But as you get better and better by reason of use in making decisions, discerning good and evil, nobody can ever call you a baby again. Nobody can ever say, man, you know, here's your bottle. The rest of us are going to sit down to a nice big T-bone, but, you know, you take the bottle here. Nobody can ever say that. It's sort of the same as saying, if you judge all things, nobody can judge you. Even God doesn't need to judge you. No man can judge you, and God doesn't need to judge you. Because God and man look down and say, look, they keep judging themselves. They make decisions about themselves. Every time they're in a situation, I notice that my servant down there, they scrutinize, they interrogate, they examine, they search, they think, and you could add, they prosecute those wrong thoughts. The Pharisees didn't do that. They were over busy in the garden. Oh, I'll take one-tenth of that plant. That's an herb, and herbs can be sold as a product. I know, because I sell herbs in my stores. Believe me, herbs can be sold. And so they're pulling the tithing. We'll keep the nine-tenths of those herbs and sell them or eat them. And they were making horrible judgments in their life, bad decisions. A lot of those decisions were affecting other people, and Christ hated it. In other places in the New Testament, he talked about it. They were horrible judges. They couldn't handle the krisis, which is just a decision to be made. 1 Corinthians 13:11. Look at what Paul said he had to do in his own life. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 11. It's in the chapter, interestingly, about love, which is about righteousness, which is about keeping the law of God and making judgments about how to keep that law in the mind, with the mouth, with the actions. Because that's really what Christianity is. It's keeping all of the laws of God by making good judgments, good decisions in areas where you might not find yourself keeping them. When I was a child, 1 Corinthians 13:11, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things, which is another way of saying to the Hebrews, stop being babies. Don't worry, brethren, I'm not calling you a bunch of babies. It can apply to any of us at any time in certain ways we conduct ourselves. But we're told, grow up. I mean, that's exactly what you read in Ephesians, by the way. It says, grow up. It says, grow up unto him in all things, who is the stature, the fullness of Christ. Maturity is just, you know, as you mature, you think about things. You meditate on things. You even go through, what would I do if I were in this situation? What would I do if I were in that situation? The older I get, the more I try to not just react to the decisions that are facing me immediately, because I guess sometimes those could be a crisis. You know, if you've got to make a decision right now, you're not ready for it, I suppose it could be a crisis. But the best crises are the ones you anticipate in advance. You know exactly what you're going to do. And when the test comes, you pass it. You've discerned good and evil. You've thought about it. You're a mature person. You've moved on. And you do the right thing. James 1 and verse 5. James 1 and verse 5 says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that gives to all men liberally. How did Solomon get that ability to discern good and evil, brethren? How did he get it? Did it fall out of the sky? Did he find it under a rock? How do you get wisdom? There's more than one way, for sure. But you ask for it. You ask for it. That's not hard to do. You just go to God and you ask for it. Over and over and over and over again. Remember, the purpose of judgment is to discern between good and evil. That's wisdom. Solomon could do that, and we talk of him as the wisest man who ever lived. He could discern good and evil. He was of full age, and by reason of use, he became the wisest man who ever lived. And when situations came to him, like the two mothers who claimed the child, he had to make a decision. He had to render a verdict right there on the spot. I could not have dreamed to say, cut the kid in two, and know that immediately I'd find out who the real mother was. I couldn't have thought of that. Could any of you have thought of that? That was a byproduct of a gift from God that by reason of use had matured him into what we now look back and call, who we now look back and call the wisest man who ever lived. He was not a man who omitted judgment because he was hung up on what was in his garden and how he should tithe on it. He was way, way past that. He made a lot of mistakes. He didn't always follow his own wisdom. Some wisdom is learned by bitter experience, and Solomon, I'm sure, will tell us that in the resurrection. Acts 17 and verse 11. Here it is in another context, Acts 17:11. Verse 10, the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night to Berea, who coming thither went into the synagogue of the Jews. Not the Berea just north of here, this is a different one. These were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched, they judged. They went through, they scrutinized, evaluated, interrogated the scriptures daily, whether those things were so. They were very, very careful. They wanted to know what was good and what was not. Romans 12 and verse 2. Look at Paul's instruction there. I beseech you, verse 1, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. It's not an unreasonable thing to do, just present yourself to God. It's a hard thing to do, but it's not unreasonable, it's right. And be not conformed to this world, but be you transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove. This is what the Bereans did all the time. What is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God? Prove what's good. Discern between good and evil. Ever since Adam and Eve ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, brethren, you and I, all of us, have been stuck with the need to discern between the two. It's just that simple. And we're either going to exercise the command to Croesus, to render verdicts and decisions, or we're not. We're either going to grow up or we're not. We're either going to become mature or we're not. Interesting what it says about the Bereans. They were more noble than the Thessalonians. Well, let's go see what the Thessalonians here for a minute. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 19. Quench not the spirit. 1 Thessalonians 5:19. Despise not prophesying, so that's inspired preaching. Don't turn around and say, I don't need to listen to that preacher. Don't do that. I hope you won't do that too. Verse 21, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. Now, history doesn't really record how well the Thessalonians did that. I don't know how well they did that. I suspect a lot of them didn't do very well, because the next chapter talks about the fact that this man of sin would come. Actually, the next book, not the next chapter, talks about how this man of sin would come before Christ returns. There would be people who were sent strong delusion because they did not love the truth. They hadn't properly proved all things and held fast that which is good. Or back to the sermonette, we could say that which is the truth. You have to discern. Doctrinally, you have to discern. A lot of people have concluded in our time that there are some truths, sure enough, you have to hold on to them. Maybe not all of them. Maybe some are not as important as others. Maybe some are not as big as others or whatever. But prove all things. That's very close to saying, judge all things. In this case, prove all things. Could be doctrinally taken, could be matters of decisions, whatever. But hold fast and do what's good. Go to the Proverbs. What are the Proverbs there for? Let's look at the introduction to the Proverbs. Why were they written? What's the synopsis purpose, if you will, for the Proverbs? Solomon wrote them. What was his purpose after he'd lived this life? Why did he write down 931 Proverbs? That's how many there are. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. Here's what they're for. Ready? To know wisdom and instruction. To perceive the words of understanding. To discern. Are you hearing good or evil? Is it giving you understanding? To receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment, and equity. Justice and judgment. To give subtlety to the simple. To the young man, knowledge and discretion. It's about perceiving understanding, wisdom, justice, judgment, fairness, knowledge, and discretion. The ability to make decisions. Remember discretion? Back there in the Old Testament, Genesis, Micah, James 1:19. It's interesting, the book of James quotes the Proverbs 12 times. Did you know that? James 1:19. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear and slow to speak, slow to wrath, swift to hear. Most people, I've often thought, I've sometimes been the same way for sure, are slow to hear, swift to speak, and swift to wrath. That's people. Not all people, but, you know, often. That's people. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Get the facts. You've got to face the decision you have to make. That's what it's saying. Think. The reason it says be slow to wrath is because in the Proverbs, James quotes him 12 times, it says, he that's soon angry deals foolishly. You know, if you're swift to wrath, or you're soon angry, you make bad decisions. You ever notice that? You ever notice when you just get hot, fast, you say destructive things? You sometimes hurt yourself. Out on the road, we call it road rage. How many people would shoot somebody else if they were dead calm, as opposed to if they were in the midst of this thing called road rage? They were soon angry. They didn't study the Proverbs that would give them discretion, wisdom, justice, judgment, which would have told them if they were studying it, don't get angry fast. Because you're going to do foolish things. You're going to make bad decisions. So in the decision-making process, be swift to hear. Brethren, listen carefully. Get the facts. Be diligent. Slow to speak. Because if everyone wants to butt in too fast, learn to backwind, crank down, ratchet down that desire, and listen more. Speak less. tone down the heat if it's rising. You're not liking what you hear. And here comes the tension and temperature rising. Slow down. Proverbs 18 and verse 13. Let's jump back there again. Hopscotching back and forth here. Proverbs 18:13. I'll stay here in Proverbs twice. Proverbs 18:13. He that answers a matter before he hears it, it's a folly and shame to him. Now, that didn't even mean you got mad. You just didn't listen. That was just one third of the problem of swift to hear, you know, slow to speak, slow to wrath. If you're just slow to hear, so swift to hear, and you answer matters, that means you make a decision. I've heard the matter, I'm going to make a decision. You're going to wind up folly and shame. You're going to make bad choices because you didn't do very well with anacrino. We can go back to that word. You didn't scrutinize. You didn't interrogate. You didn't very carefully go through, investigate, determine, search, examine, think. Remember, Christ said we're not to omit these things. This is important. It's very, very important, brethren. Proverbs 2. 2:2. Proverbs 2:2. You'll receive my words and hide my commandments with you, so that you will incline your ear unto wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Yes, if you cry after knowledge and lift up your voice for understanding, cry after it, ask God for it. If you seek her as silver and search for her as for hid treasures, then shall you understand the fear of God and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. No wonder James quotes so much back here from the Proverbs and says, you want wisdom? Ask it. That's another way of saying Proverbs 2:6. Out of his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He lays up sound wisdom for the righteous. It's judgment and the love of God, the keeping of the commandments. He is a buckler to them that walk uprightly. He keeps the paths of judgment and preserves the way of his saints. Then shall you understand, if you do all those things from verse 1 on, then shall you understand righteousness, that's the law and the love of God, and judgment, that's good decision-making, and equity. And yes, every good path. There you find judgment again, and equity, that's fairness, tied right in with judgment, and every good path, good things. That's another way of saying prove all things. And hold fast that which is good. Prove every good path. Prove all things. Paul to the Corinthians, judge all things, and you won't have to be judged. Exodus 18. When the judges were picked in Israel, what did they look for? Exodus chapter 18 and verse 13. Exodus 18:13. It came to pass in the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning to the evening. Long story there. He was getting tired. His father-in-law said, we're tired too. You're not the only guy tired here. You're standing there all day long from morning to evening, lining up, you know, and it's too heavy for you. You can't perform it alone, so pick some other guys. Father-in-laws can do that kind of thing. Verse 21, moreover, you shall provide out of the people, notice, able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetous. Turn to Deuteronomy 1:13 and keep your hand there. Deuteronomy 1, verse 13. God is telling Moses what to do. Take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. God told Moses, verse 15, Moses did it. So I took the chief of your tribes, he's giving this 11-chapter sermon to all of Israel there, because God told him to do that. And I picked wise men and known and made them heads over you. In verse 16, and I charged your judges at that time. So there's the account. He was told to do it. God told him to do it through his father-in-law. And he did it, and the account we read about later, you know, validates it or verifies it. Able men who fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, wise men, understanding, and known. Known. They're known as being people who make good judgments. And people, it was those, you can't judge those people. They're judged of no man. The only judgment you make is that they're good judges. Those are the qualifications of judges in the Old Testament. It's quite a list of skills, abilities, capacity. John 7:24. Back to the New Testament. John 7:24. Judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment. This is from the very same Christ who started out in Matthew 7, verse 1, and said, judge not that you be not judged. Here he says, judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. He's telling people who want to be killing, basically. 1 Corinthians 11. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Verse 29, for he that eats and drinks unworthily, eats and drinks judgment, condemnation to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. Isn't that interesting? On the Passover a few weeks ago, we were supposed to make some judgments, some discernments about what that body represented. One of the heresies that was presented some years ago, one of the earliest heresies of all, some groups are still into it, is that you can't separate the body and blood of Jesus Christ, which denigrates, by your stripes we're healed, by his stripes we're healed. And it diminishes the healing doctrine. And it starts because people did not discern the Lord's body. And they bring judgment on themselves. But, verse 31, for if we would judge ourselves, either the spiritual judges all things, we should not be judged. You don't have to be judged. And no man is judged of no man or God. If we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged. But when we are judged, because most people don't judge all things, they don't judge themselves, they don't do all of the scriptures that we've said, so God does have to judge them sometimes. But when we're judged, we're chastened to the Lord, that we should not be condemned with the world. So God does sometimes have to do it. Isaiah 1:26. Let's link some final verses here in the conclusion of the sermon. Isaiah 1:26. It's probably a sermon that I could give at the feast. And I will restore your judges. This is a millennial prophecy. I will turn my hand upon you and purely purge away your dross and take away all your tin. And I will restore your judges as at the first, and your counselors as at the beginning. Afterward, you shall be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. Because when you're involved in judgment, right judgment, you're righteous, you're keeping the law, which is the love of God, and of course you understand mercy. Remember what Christ said at the beginning there? You've omitted the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Isn't it interesting that once judgment enters, which is the ability to discern all the right and wrong, you've got people keeping the law, who know how to show mercy, and who have faith. It all ties together. Daniel chapter 7. God says he's going to restore judges and counselors. It's interesting. Judges, plural, and counselors. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 22. Until the Ancient of Days came, verse 21 says, I beheld and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, because, the time came because the time had come that the saints possessed the kingdom. Guess who the judges and counselors are going to be? They're going to be people who grew up, who weren't babies anymore, who by reason of a lifetime of use in their conversion, learned to discern good and evil. And they're going to be used as judges and counselors to help people, millions and eventually billions of them, do the same. What we're going through has a real practical end of the game, if you will, application. Revelation 20 and verse 4. Revelation 20 and verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they that sat on them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the righteousness, for the word of God, which had not worshipped the beast, and so forth. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Well, that's Revelation's way of saying that Daniel 7:22 is going to happen. 1 Corinthians 6. Why do you not go to court before the judges of this world? Can you better understand, brethren, why God says this? Dare any of you, 1 Corinthians 6:1, having a matter against another, go to law before the unjust and not before the saints? They don't know how to be judges. They've been given reprobate minds. That's its own whole sermon. The ones who are practicing to be judges, who have the Spirit of God, who have been commanded to learn to decision make in their lives, to never ever forget or omit the importance of decision making, of rendering verdicts in their life. Do you not know that the saints shall judge the world? Well, if they'd read Daniel 7:22, they would, and many other verses. And if the world shall be judged by you, and it really is, brethren, it really is going to be judged by us. Are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? In other words, you've got to go to some carnal judge out there? Why, know you not that you're going to judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? How are you doing? How are you doing? Hopefully, we're not people where God would look at us and say, you're unworthy to judge the smallest matters. I mean, you can't even handle little stuff. And I'm supposed to have you someday help fulfill the prophecy in Isaiah 1:26 that I'm going to restore judges and counselors, is it the first? So that Jerusalem will be known as a city of righteousness and faith, and you guys can't even judge these little matters. And of course, you know what was going on in Corinth. They weren't doing very well. Final scripture, Psalm 82. Psalm 82. This verse really became a bone of contention when the heresy was taught that we were no longer going to become God. And I listened to the man who quoted this, and apparently he was better in his native Greek than he was with Hebrew, because he did not understand this verse. Psalm 82:1, God stands in the congregation of the mighty. He judges among the gods, the Elohim. How long will you judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? Selah, so be it. Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Rid them out of the hand of the wicked. This will all happen at Christ's return. They know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness, and all the foundations of the world are out of course. I have said, you are gods. And Elohim was almost always translated as gods. But you know, the Hebrews had no separate word for judges. The word Elohim could be translated, you are judges. And one tried to say, see, it doesn't say we're going to be gods, it says we're going to be judges. Well, all right, let's focus on the fact that as God, you'll be a judge. And all of you are children of the Most High. But you shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Arise, O God, David prayed. Verse 8, this is the Psalm of Asaph. Judge the whole earth, for you shall inherit all nations. Well, someday God will be all of us. We won't be the Father, we won't be Christ, but we will all be God's. And Christ quoted that verse in John. Have you not read that it says, you are God's? Now, the Greeks did have two different words for gods and judges. Theos means God, and krinos means judge. And Christ picked the word theos. You are God's. Brethren, someday as God, we are going to judge the world. If you have learned to judge everything from the smallest to the great matters in your life, and you have not omitted those weightier matters, and you have learned to live the right way, then you will be ready when God arises to judge the earth.